Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on taxes when we come back. You know, when you're making $50,000 a year, you pay $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Then, in addition to that, you pay a 17% income tax on that same $50,000 a second time. That's another $8,500. Now, you just paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. And that makes the real effective Social Security tax rate 17.8%. It's not the 15.3% that's being advertised. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Help take a bite out of crime. Call and ask for our free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, educational, informative, and best of all, it's free. Now, tax and status is available on compact disc. That's our school for home education. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about the third rail of politics. It's called Social Security. Everybody loves Social Security. Everybody's looking forward to retiring on Social Security. If you're going to retire on Social Security between now and the year 2012, you're all right. You'll probably get paid some of the money, not all, but some of the money you paid in. That depends upon how long the world economy continues on. And Social Security has enough funding in it to last us until 2032, when it will have a $3.8 trillion deficit. Now, that's what's projected. Of course, 2032, you know, that's another 25 years or so away. And a lot happens in 25 years, and the numbers aren't always going to be the same, and the projections aren't going to prove out, and it'll be a lot worse than what they're projecting, but that's the best-case scenario. Now, I said Social Security was a Ponzi scheme, and now let me demonstrate it. Back in 1935, Social Security was enacted, taxes were collected, and in 1940, the first lady to draw money out of Social Security started drawing. By 1945, 10 years after it had been initiated, Social Security was paying out at the rate of 45 to 1. That is, 45 people were paying into the fund for everybody drawn out of it. By 1957, just add another 12 years to that, the ratio dropping to 16 to 1. So now 16 people are paying in, one person's drawn out. Go back to 1995, three people are paying in, one person is drawing out. Today, it's around 2 to 1, and by 2020, it will be 1 to 1. Now, boys and girls, that's the first sign that tells you. You go back to the beginning, you got 45 people paying in, and as time progresses along, they've had to lower it down to where now it's at 2 to 1, headed to 1 to 1. There's a second factor. When they started collecting the tax in 1935, it was one-half of 1% from the employer, one-half of 1% from the employee. That was 1% is being paid in. By 1950, they were taking 2.25%. Then by 1970, they're taking 6.9%. And then by 1980, it's 8.1%. And then by 1992, they're taking out 15.3%. So it goes from 1% in 1935 to 15.3%, which is where it's at today. Now, this is for self-employed. What do you see there, kids? So they had to increase it from 1% to 15%. And then the number of people that are drawing out has constantly increased, and the number of people paying in has constantly decreased. And there's a third factor. The maximum in 1951, I don't have the numbers back to 35, but in 1951, the maximum amount that was being taxed was $3,600. 1970, they were taxing it on $7,800. By 1980, it was $25,900. By 1990, it was $51,300. By 2000, it was $76,200. Three factors are being factored in. Number one, you've got fewer people paying in and more people drawing out. The percentage has continually gone up from 1% to 15%, and the amount of money being taxed has continually gone up from $3,600 in 1950 to $76,000 in the year 2000. All three factors are working toward and aiming toward the ultimate collapse of the system. When is it going to collapse? I don't know. It's already happened in a number of countries. I remember 20 years ago down in Uruguay, their Social Security retirement system went upside down. You people have been watching it with United Airlines. It went upside down. You people at Delta Airlines are watching it now. It's going upside down. Shortly, every corporation in America is going to turn its retirement program upside down, bankrupt out of it, and leave it to the government to pay. You're not going to get your retirement. If you're sitting back dreaming about retirement over the next 20 or 30 years, you got the head up the wrong end of the anatomy. Bottom line. It ain't going to happen. So it's time to sit down and start learning how to count. You know, if you learn how to count, like I did by age 37, maybe there's a little hope for you. Now, I don't care what you do. I'm not getting on the air and jumping up and down on my soapbox trying to get you to vote for this guy or vote for that guy. Nobody's going to change Social Security. What has to be done to save the system, if in fact it was salvageable, and I don't have enough moxie to save Social Security. I mean, that's like saying, well, we're on the Titanic. We've already hit the iceberg. Now, who on board the ship has got the moxie to save the ship from sinking? Well, taint me. I don't know. The best thing that I could figure out to do was to get the hell off the ship. So I got off back in 78. That was my conclusion. Get off the ship. Now, the ship has continually stayed afloat now for the last 30 years, and now finally we're at the point where this thing is going to sink. We can all see that. Everybody's sitting here waiting on the sidelines. Is it the hedge funds? Is it the derivatives? Is it the balance of payments deficit? What is the trigger that's going to kick over the U.S. economy and then the world economy? Well, I don't know. And I don't know of anybody else that knows, but we're all sitting back there with bated breath and waiting. So I figured that it was time to get off the ship, time to do something more constructive, something more intelligent. So that's why I didn't waste my time retiring. I'm old enough to retire, and I'm just like everybody else. I'd like to retire and quit working and drive around the country in my Winnebago and look at the sights. And then one of these days when the thing turns turtle, then what am I going to do? And you guys, you know, that are at United Airlines and retired, and you've been retired for a number of years, that's the dilemma that you find yourselves in, isn't it? I mean, you were retired, and now all of a sudden your retirement is, the checks aren't enough to cover expenses, and now what are you going to do? Go down to Walmart and greet people at the door for minimum wage? I mean, you know, you got to do something, don't you? So maybe you'd have been better off staying on the job and working and continuing, or saving money on the side, or working with an annuity, or doing something different, buying gold and silver, or buying Swiss francs, or investing in the Swiss stock market, or, you know, anything better than what you did. Because if it's not working out for you, then obviously you could have done something different or something better. But there's no sense crying over spilt milk. You know, the chessboard is where the chessboard is. And when you've lost your queen and a rook, you don't sit there and say, well, game's over. You know, you say, okay, well, we got to play the game, but now we're handicapped. Handicapped, but game's not over yet. Not over by a long shot. Now, I told you about Social Security by the numbers in the last program. Let me give you a little piece from Colin Powell. Colin Powell, as it relates, a little off point, but something that was very important that he said. Colin Powell, finding the Russian scientists may be a problem, being that Russia does not have a social security system as here in America that allows us to monitor, track down, and capture an American citizen. Did you get that? Colin Powell, former Secretary of State. He said, talking about some Russian scientists that they were looking for, he said, finding the Russian scientists may be a problem, being that Russia does not have a social security system as here in America that allows us to monitor, track down, and capture an American citizen. Social Security, boys and girls, to you is a retirement program, but to government, it's the methodology whereby we track you down. And pretty soon they're not going to be paying you. Yeah, they're giving you some money now, but all of the money that Social Security gives you, you already paid it in. You already paid it in. So don't think that the government's giving you anything. And when I listen to people, you know, they're talking about their Social Security and how government's doing all these wonderful things for them. Hey, kids, wait a minute. Hang on a second. The government first takes 16% of your money and they take it away from you and they give it to somebody else. 40 years from now, they take it from somebody else and give it to you. That's called income redistribution. Has nothing to do with investment. Has nothing to do with savings. It has to do with the police power of the state taking the money from one guy and giving it to another. It's Robin Hood. I mean, I could do that and so could you. Here's what we do. We walk down on Broadway, Times Square in New York. We stick a gun in some guy's ribs and we say, give me your money. You could be a nice guy and say, we don't want it all. Just give us $50. And we take the $50, we walk over to some bum sitting in a doorway and we hand him the $50 and we say, we're a great benefactor. We are the government. And we're here to help you. The guy in the doorway says, God, you're wonderful. I love you. The guy you took the money away from, he might hate you, but you could explain it to him and say, listen, we got to help that guy in the doorway over there, and so I'm going to use the police power of the state because you've got so much and he has so little, and we're going to redistribute this income. We could get ourselves voted into office repeatedly. Here's what we do. We go up to three guys, stick a gun in their ribs, and we take $100 from each one of them. That's $300. Then we walk over to 10 bums in the doorway, register them to vote, and give each one of those bums in the doorway $66 out of our $300. Is that the right amount? Let's take 10 guys, $300. 300 divided by 10. $30 each. We give each one of them $30. And then we register them to vote. Those 10 guys are going to vote for you. And the three guys you took the money away from, they're going to vote against you. We win the election, and we stay in office. Now, this is the way this game has been played. They take the money away from you under the police power of the state, and then they promise to give it back to you. Well, less the costs of administration, which I covered last time. And the cost of administration for minimum wage is, what was it, 30-some cents. And for middle income, it was about 38 cents, I believe, on the dollar. That's what they're going to pay back. And then if you're in a high income bracket and you're making, you know, $100,000 a year, they're going to give you back $1 out of every five, or about 20 or 25 cents out of each dollar they take from it. And this is the third rail, the third rail of politics. Hey, when I did the arithmetic on this, I couldn't get out of Social Security fast enough. And as I pointed out, I said, I saved $140,000. Invested it in something else. And boys and girls, if I hadn't invested it in something else, I'd have burned it up in airplane gas before I'd give it to Social Security. All right, now, there's a holy grail. Remember I mentioned this a while back? I said the holy grail in law is called property and property rights. Now, we talked about this the other day. You know, you're working on your job, and you're working for $10 an hour, 40 hours a week. See, 10 times 40, you know, get your sharp Texas Instruments EL1197G out there and punch in these numbers. 40 hours a week, $10 an hour. Let's see, that's $400. All right. Now, when was the last time you got a $400 check? If the answer is, I never have seen a $400 check for 40 hours of work at $10 an hour. That's right. Somebody was in there and made some deductions, and they took all of your deductions out and sent them off to some guy and left you with $300. So they took $100 out of your paycheck. Now remember, you got labor, and you're giving your labor to your employer, and your labor is being taxed. Now, you might have heard somebody say you can't tax labor. Well, listen to this. This is Labor and Labor Relations from 48 American Jurisprudence, 2nd edition, page 80, section 1. Listen to this. In labor laws, the term labor may be used in a comprehensive sense, all-inclusive sense, as including those who toil with their brains as well as those performing manual work. So whether you're digging a ditch for a living or you're selling houses, in a comprehensive sense, the term labor applies to both. Now, you have a constitutional protection of your right to work in Section 2. The right to labor and to its protection from unlawful interference is a constitutional as well as a common law right. And every man has a natural right to the fruits of his own industry. Labor is deemed to be property. Did you get that? I underline that. Pause, pause, stop, stop. Listen to this. Labor is deemed to be property. Property is the holy grail of law. Property. Now, labor is deemed to be property, especially within the meaning of the constitutional guarantees. Thus, the right to acquire property includes the right to acquire property by labor. You've got a right to acquire houses and cars and snowmobiles and motorcycles by your labor. To acquire property includes the right to acquire property by labor. The right to earn wages is just as much property, and within the protection of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the Federal Constitution, as are earned wages. And since the right to labor is protected by the 14th Amendment and numerous guarantees of state constitutions, one cannot be deprived of such right by arbitrary mandate of the legislature, and it merits legal protection. Such right is likewise embraced by the 5th Amendment to the Federal Constitution. Let me count up all of the footnotes here. Here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 footnotes. And let me count them at the bottom. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. I got 13 footnotes at the bottom. 11 of these footnotes are cited on this page. This is page 80 of Labor and Labor Relations in cases like United States versus National Association of Real Estate Boards, Bogney versus Perotti, Adair versus United States. I mean, you go down the footnotes, and that's the story. Property is protected by the 5th and 14th Amendment and numerous statutes of various states. All right. Now, if that's the case, then how in the hell does government come in here and tax your paycheck? I get asked that question over and over again, and people, they just kind of scratch their heads and say, oh my God, how does the government do that? Well, that's unconstitutional. Why, they can't do that. Well, whether they can or not, they've been doing it for nigh on to 100 years. And the truth of the matter is, the Supreme Court says it's perfectly constitutional. So then there's got to be an answer to the riddle, doesn't there? Got to be an answer to the riddle. The answer to the riddle is in an obscure case that comes out of a state Supreme Court in Idaho. It's not the only case on the subject that tells you the story, but it's a good one. It's a good case, and it tells you pretty much in just plain language what the story is. Another thing that protesters or tax protesters will say to me, they call on the telephone or they write letters and emails, and they say, there's no place in Title 26 that defines income. Oh, yeah, there is. Yeah, there's two places in Title 26 that defines income, and numerous Supreme Court cases that define income. And the Supreme Court of Idaho defined income in a case called Diefendorf versus Galay. Diefendorf versus Galay, spelled G-A-L-L-E-T, Galay. 51 Idaho 619. That's the site. 51 Idaho 619. And the Supreme Court of Idaho, this is back in 1932, said, okay, now look, income is defined as. You want to know what income is? Here's the Supreme Court of Idaho. Pretty smart guys. Pretty smart guy. And every Supreme Court in the United States has followed this principle of definition. Everyone. Well, there was one exception. One time, the Supreme Court of Alabama, you'd expect this from them hillbillies down near in the South. In 1928, the Supreme Court of Alabama erroneously determined that income was property. They did that. But it was a mistake. And in 1932, 5 years later, they reversed themselves so that they would fit into the other 48 states and the Supreme Court of the United States. So let me tell you, boys and girls, that today in the 21st century, the Supreme Court of the United States and every state Supreme Court knows and understands, and I'll tell you plainly, that income is defined as something. God, I thought you'd love that one. What is income? Okay. Income is something. I'm not lying to you. I'm just reading it right off the page here. And then there's a footnote that goes along with this. But I'm going to tell you it's something. And whatever this something is, it is derived from property. Income is not property, and property is not taxed as income, but income is something, and whatever the something is, it is derived from property, labor, skill, ingenuity, or sound judgment, or from two or more in combination. Cited from Stony Brook Railroad Corporation versus Boston and Maine Railroad Company. Cited at 260 Massachusetts, 379. All right. Stony Brook Rail Corporation versus Boston and Maine Rail Company, 260 Massachusetts, 379. All right. Now, we're going to run this by you again. See if you can grasp this. Very simple principle of law. Income is something. We don't know what it is. But whatever income is, it is derived from property. It isn't property, but it's derived from property. Now, God's a little different. Boy. This is the exact opposite from the way God handles it. See, God comes along, He taxes property directly. Property directly. In fact, if you've got cattle, and I have cows here, when I pay my tithe, I run my sheep under a rod. See, they run down a chute. They come out of a big corral, go into a chute, and they run down that chute, and we put a rod over the top of the two boards on each side of this chute. And every tenth sheep is the one God gets. God does not take something derived from property. By God, He wants the damn sheep. He wants the cow. He wants the calf. He wants the gold. He wants the stuff. God doesn't want to be paid with a check. He wants the real deal. But income does not reach property. Income does not tax property. Property has never been assessed or taxed in the United States. Listen to what the court went on to say on page 628, they said, now the same meaning appears to have attached to the term property in all subsequent taxing legislation and in the taxing practices of the executives. And we take judicial notice that income as such has never been assessed or taxed as property in the state of Idaho. Income has never been assessed or taxed as property, not only in the state of Idaho, but not even in the state of Alabama, where they made that little mistake back in 28, nor in the United States. And I hear people tell me that, well, you know, the income tax and the federal jurisdiction only applies in the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. And okay, well, you go out there and you test that theory and see what happens to you. Because everybody that I've observed over the last 20 or 30 years been doing that goes to prison. I don't want to get in the way of people's happiness and success. If prison is your thing in life, get after it. But I thought I'd forbear. Page 633. Now here's income. Listen to this. Idaho Supreme Court. Comes right out of the mouth of the judge. He says, income is necessarily the product of the joint efforts of the state and the recipient of the income. The state furnishing the protection necessary to enable the recipient to produce, to receive, and to enjoy it. And a tax thereon, in the last analysis, is simply a portion cut from the income and appropriated by the state as its share thereof. So I put brackets on both sides of that. I underlined the whole thing. Listen now. Income is necessarily the product of the joint efforts of the state and the recipient of the income, Joe. You and the state are in a joint venture. This is a partnership. Do you remember when you went down and signed this partnership agreement with the state of Idaho or New York or Florida or the United States of America or France or England or Australia or Canada? Do you remember when you signed this contract? Can't remember, huh? I'm going to remind you. Going on. The state furnishes the protection necessary to enable the recipient to produce, receive, and enjoy it. Did you get that? The state furnishes the protection. So you should put a bracket around the word protection. If the mafia comes up to your little business in New York, they walk in and they say, you need to pay us $200 a week protection money to make sure that your store doesn't burn down or something real bad doesn't happen. You don't pay the $200 a week, your store burns down or somebody shoots you. See, something bad happened. Then pay your protection money. The United States comes along, and then they say, listen, you need to pay the income tax. It's protection. We'll protect you from Osama bin Laden. We'll protect you from Adolf Hitler. And if you don't pay us this money over here, something real bad's going to happen. We're going to take your store away from you and give it to somebody else and put you in prison for 5 or 10 years. The income tax. This is a judge writing this. The income tax is a partnership called a joint effort, and it's a protection racket. But there's more. There's more. The tax thereon, the tax on you or your business, in the last analysis is simply a portion cut from the income and appropriated by the state as its share thereof. It's the state's share of this joint venture. Yeah, I used to be a partner with the state. And then one day I woke up and I said, you know, I really don't like the state as a partner. I want to dissolve this partnership. I want to get the hell out of Dodge. So I dissolved my partnership with the state of Idaho and my partnership with the USA Incorporated. I said, boys, it's been a pleasure doing business with you. I appreciate the opportunities that you've given me. But I've decided to go alone. And they threatened me and they said, oh my God, you'll starve to death. You'll never be able to make it alone. You can't live your life without government. You can't live your life without the bank. You can't live your life without the insurance company. You can't live your life without Social Security, the income tax, and the protections that the state offers. And I said, well, give me a shot at it, would you? I know I'm probably going to die in the next 6 months or a year because I don't have all these protections and all these needed benefits, but let me give it a go. And I left. And I didn't die. And I survived. In fact, I not only survived, but I thrived. I'm happy as a clam at high tide. Now, there's a final little story here that comes out of Idaho. The same meaning appears to have attached to the term property in all subsequent taxing legislation and in the taxing practices of the executives, and we take judicial notice that income as such has never been assessed or taxed as property in the state of Idaho. Did you get that? Never been assessed or taxed. It's a joint effort by you and the state. It's a protection racket. And it's a portion that the state cuts out of the program as their share thereof. They went on to say, much confusion of thought arises from regarding the income tax as a tax that's levied on or attaches to property as such, irrespective of the person sought to be taxed. It is the recipient of the income that is taxed, not his property. Boys and girls, they're taxing you, not your property. That's against the law. Now, how in the hell does the government get away with coming out here and taxing? You know, you work 40 hours, $10 an hour is what you agreed to. At the end of the week, you don't get paid $400, you get paid $300. So they're definitely taking $100. And your labor is property, so they must be taxing your property. No. No, they're not taxing your property. That's against the law. Well, then it must be taxing my labor. No. Can't tax your labor. That's your property. What are they taxing? What in the world is the government taxing if they're not taxing your labor and they're not taxing your property? Okay, you hang on there. I'll give you your mid-course correction here, and we'll come back and we'll tell you what they're taxing right after this. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Well, what is it that the government's taxing if they can't tax your labor and can't tax your property, and you go to work and you're laboring and you get a paycheck, but you don't get everything that you agreed to with your employer? Somebody's taking your property. Somebody is taking your labor or a portion thereof. Who's doing it? How do they get away with it? All right. The Supreme Court went on to say the tax is upon the right or the ability to produce, create, receive, and enjoy, and not on specific property. But the tax does not seek to reach property or an interest in property as such. It is a burden laid upon the recipient of an income. And upon a complete survey of the field of precedent, we have reached the independent conclusion that income is not property for the purposes of taxation under the provisions of our Constitution. All right. Remember back in 1933, the Congress of the United States enacted an obscure, little-known House Joint Resolution called 192. There was a banking crisis. America couldn't pay its bills. There was a depression on. Congress and the president came together and they said, okay, let's call in all the gold. And they took away all of the gold from you people out there so that you could not buy, sell, or trade any longer in gold coin. And because of the depression and because of the unemployment, people thought, well, God bless President Roosevelt, he's doing something. We don't know what he's doing and we don't know why he's doing it, but he's doing something, and God bless President Roosevelt. Roosevelt was taking away from you your ability to own property, your ability to convert your labor into property. See, when you come here and you say to me, well, I've got a horse and I want to trade that horse for a cow. All right, that's livestock for like livestock. That's like kind. That's a horse for a cow. That's a property transaction. You people don't do business like that. You come here with money in your pocket. You take the horse to the sale barn, you sell the horse. Now you've got dollars in your pocket and you come over here and buy my cow. I take the dollars and I go out and buy the horse. That brings a third party into the action, doesn't it? It's not a two-party transaction between me and you. It's a three-party transaction. In this case, a four-party transaction between you and the sale barn. And then the sale barn and me. And the proceeds are the horse and the cow. And the Federal Reserve comes into the program. And the Federal Reserve is entitled to get paid for their services, which is in making the paper in which we transacted our business. It's their commission. The income tax in the final analysis is simply the commission paid for the use of somebody else's debt notes. You know, if you went out and you dug some gold out of the ground, and you brought it over to me and said, here, Gordon, here's some gold that I dug out of the ground. I'd like to trade it to you for a cow. I give you the cow. I've got the gold. It's a two-party property transaction. Your property was your labor, which took the gold out of the ground. My property was my cow that I raised. I trade my property for your property. Property's never been assessed or taxed in the United States. But you go dig your gold out of the ground, then you take it over here and you sell it and you take Federal Reserve notes, and then you come over to me and you say, I'd like to give you these Federal Reserve notes for the cow. I take the Federal Reserve notes for the cow, and both of us owe an income tax. Both of us owe a commission to the fella that generated those Federal Reserve notes for us to conduct our business. Now, when we had our gold coin, boys and girls, we didn't have the Federal Reserve. So the government and the Federal Reserve got together and said, you know what we got to do is we've got to deprive these people of their common law right to property and institute the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to property, and take these people's property right, which is guaranteed under the Eighth Commandment, which says, thou shalt not steal. We've got to induce these people to use unjust weights and balances so that we can charge a commission on our unjust weights and balances, which are prohibited in the scripture in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36 and Deuteronomy 25, 13 through 16. And we all said, we think that's a marvelous idea. To hell with God and let's go get in bed with the whores at the Federal Reserve. And we did. So don't complain about the federal income tax or your state income tax. Hey, troops, The tax isn't on your labor, and the tax isn't on any property of yours. It's a contract that you made through Social Security. Yep, that's right, Social Security. And here's the way that game was played. 1935, they came to you and they said, you know, Henry Ford made $30 million last year. This was back in the Depression years, and they used Henry Ford as the whipping boy. And they said, Henry Ford made $30 million, and he ain't paying his fair share. And what we need a taxing system in which Henry Ford pays his fair share. Boys and girls, the rich people of America have never paid their fair share, are not paying their fair share today, and are never going to pay their fair share looking out into the future. And that's because the rich aren't taxed. Well, it shouldn't say they're not taxed. They're taxed at a much lesser rate than us little guys down here making $10,000 a year. Well, I told you this the other day. When you go down to buy a gallon of gasoline, it costs $3. And the guy in the gas station doesn't say, gee, what's your income level? And if you're making $100,000 a year, you got to pay $6 a gallon for gas. If you're making $1 million a year, you got to pay $12 a gallon for gas. But if you're only making $10,000, we only charge $1.50 for a gallon of gas. When you go down to the gas station, it costs the same amount of money to buy the gallon of gas. That's why the rich guy, he pays a little tax, but it isn't anywhere near the percentage. It isn't anywhere near as much as the little guy. Let me give you an illustration. You're a plumber, you're a carpenter, you're a mechanic, and you're making $42,000 a year. All right? It's called the median average wage. Do you know what the median average CEO wage is in the United States? Well, it's $42,000 times 282. $11,844,000 a year. Let me repeat that. The average, mediocre, everyday, garden variety CEO working in corporate America makes $11,844,000 a year. Then he goes down to the gas station to buy a gallon of gas, which costs $3. Which, by the way, is the same price that gasoline was in 1950. Gasoline in 1950 was 30 cents a gallon. Today it's $3, and prices have gone up 10 times since 1950. It's the same price, the same number of hours of your time that it takes to earn the money to buy a gallon of gasoline today is the same amount of time that it took to earn a gallon of gasoline in 1950. The kicker is that in 1950, when you were making $3,600 a year, $3,600 a year, remember that? And you paid your Social Security tax, you were paying $81 in Social Security tax. I'm looking for my paper here. Don't run off on me now. As soon as I find it here, I'm going to give you another shocking number. Here it is. Now let's go down here to where you're making $10,000 a year, which was about 1973. The maximum taxed was 8% of $10,800, or $864. Okay, now let's see what you're being taxed. $10,800. Get my famous sharp EL1197 out here. $10,800. Now let's multiply that times 16.1, and you're now paying $1,738.80. You were paying $900, now you're paying $1,800. So you're paying twice as much on your Social Security. Twice as much as you were in 1950 for the hours that you work. And that's called purchasing power. Purchasing power. And, you know, we go to public school and they teach us dollars or dollars or dollars or dollars or dollars. And that's BS. In 1930, $20, a $20 Federal Reserve note was equal to 1 ounce of gold. Now today gold's pushing $600 an ounce. $600 an ounce. It's underpriced, but even at that, it's $600. Now if you'd have saved an ounce of gold from 1930 to 2006, you still got the same purchasing power as you had in 1930. But if you saved the $20 Federal Reserve note from 1930 to today, your Federal Reserve note is $20, but your $20 Double Eagle is $600. How many times is that more than 600 divided by 20? 30 times more. The gold is 30 times more than the paper. Your purchasing power is 30 times greater with the gold than it is with the paper. You take a look at your paper money and its purchasing power in 1930 to 2006, it's lost 97% of its purchasing power. You say, well, we keep making more money. That's true. That's true. That means that you should be making 30 times more money than you were making in 1930. So, you were making $5 a day in 1930. So let's just take 5 times 30. And your wages should be $150 a day. Are you making $150 a day? Because if you are, then you have just stayed even with purchasing power in 1930. And if you're not making $150 a day, then you didn't stay even with purchasing power. Now, that's the way that game is played. And that's your minimum. And if you were going to make any more than that, you know, depending upon, you know, your station in life, if you were a plumber in 1930, you should have been making $8 a day. And so, let's take 8 times 30. You should be making $240 a day. Are you making $240? You know, if you're a plumber and you're not making $240 a day, you're not staying up with inflation from 1930 to 2006. If you're a minimum wage earner at the bottom of the heap in 1930, you know, if you're not making $150 a day, then you're not making it. Now, if you were really on top of things, you'd have been making $12 a day in 1930 times 30 would be $360 a day, okay? If you're a real estate broker, if you're a lawyer, if you're a, you know, you're a somebody, a professional, you need to be making $360 a day to keep up with what you'd have been making in 1930. Now, since 1973, we have not been keeping up with purchasing power. That's the bottom line to that story. You're not keeping up. The taxes are indexed progressively. The progressive income tax. The more dollars you earn, the higher percentage you pay in taxes. I remember one time I was working for wages, made $126 a week was my net take-home pay. Then I got some overtime. And when I got through making the deductions on the overtime, I was taking home $123 a week. I get in time and a half, got a few more hours, kicked me up into the next tax bracket, and I get $123. I get $5 less money. Well, I got more money paid into my tax account, so at the end of the year, I get a bigger tax refund. All that means is that the government takes my money interest-free and uses it for a year, and then they give it back to me. Well, isn't that just real big of them? You take my money, use it for a year, give it back to me, and I'm supposed to think that you're just a real nice guy. Social Security takes $5 away from you, keeps it for 45 years, gives you one of them back, and says, aren't we just real nice guys? I mean, have we taken leave of our senses, and then we vote for this kind of crap? Huh? Now, the state may require private individuals to obtain a state-created franchise, such as a license to work for the state or any of its corporate creations. A corporation is a creature of the state, and a corporation can be compelled to require a prospective employee to possess a Social Security number, which is evidence of a state-created franchise. And they can do that prior to, before they hire that applicant. And this is because an individual has no common law right to work for a corporation. Now, isn't that just special? You, as an individual, have no common law right to work for a corporation. Now, we're coming to Hale versus Henkel. Next program, we'll pull out the Hale case, and I'll show you how that ties into this. Corporations are a creature of the civil law, not the common law. And the common law. The common law, remember, boys and girls, dates back to Moses at Mount Sinai. It comes from the Ten Commandments. That's our common law. The law of the commoners. It does not recognize corporations created under the civil law. Corporations are juristic state-created persons, and under corporate law, the creator of the corporation, the state, can demand anything that it desires from its creation, such as regulation by statute and taxation, and may even destroy that corporation by use of taxation. And just as a state employee must obtain a Social Security number and pay an income tax on the privilege of working for the state, that's a franchise, that's a privilege, that's an excise tax. Working for the state, the individual free man who is otherwise unenfranchised must admit to enfranchisement to work for the state or one of its corporations. Boys and girls, you have to have a Social Security number. And a Social Security number is your taxpayer identification number. Got that? The 1964 Act, I forgot it's public law such and such, we'll see what public law that is, I'll look that up for you. 1964 was the magic year. They converted your Social Security account. Not that that it was anything different. See, in 1935, when you joined Social Security, you joined the regulated enterprise by which you could be taxed. But they didn't put this tax on you as an individual until 1942. They had a name for this tax now. I'll think of it here in a minute. 1942. The Victory Tax Act. Victory Tax Act. That's when the income started on individuals. Remember, the income tax came upon us in 1913. But the income tax was only on corporations and professionals until 1942. The authority for placing that tax on individuals came from the partnership agreement that you made under the Social Security Act, Title 42, Section 301 through 336. Now that's where your contract is. That's where your agreement is. So don't sit here and complain now about the government taxing your wages. They're not taxing your labor. They're not taxing your wages. They're not taxing your property. They're taxing the unjust weights and balances, the Federal Reserve notes, which are civil law methodology for accounting, not the common law methodology, which is gold and silver coin. Now, boys and girls, our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. And our politicians did not take our gold and silver coin away from us back in 1933 for no good purpose. They took it away from us so that they could tax our wages. And that's because when we joined Social Security, we joined regulation and control in a corporate capacity. And when you join corporate capacity, you'll be treated as a corporation. You're being treated just like General Motors, your employer. I remember one time I had a judge tell me that she wanted to fine me $300, and I said, "Well, you can't do that." And so she gave me what's known as a judgment debtor's hearing. Okay, Hamilton, traffic court judge, Boise, Idaho, 1983. A judgment debtor's hearing, and she asked me about 25 questions, and she said, "Hey, you got a job?" "No, no, I don't have a job." And she said, "Well, have you got unemployment insurance?" Nope, I don't have any unemployment insurance." I said, well, have you got any money in the bank?" Nope, I don't have any money in the bank." And she asked me about 20 questions like that. Pretty soon she said, well, are you looking for work?" And I said, nope, I'm not looking for work." And she was really shocked when I said, "I'm not looking for work." See, today I'm an old man, so you could understand me not looking for work today because I'm 67. But, you know, when I was 30 and I said, no, I'm not looking for work. And she looked at me and she said, why aren't you looking for work? And I said, because I'm unemployable. I'm unemployable. And she was just shocked. She looked at me and she could see that I wasn't crippled. And she said, well, why are you unemployable? And I said, because I don't have a social security number. That's the winning argument right there. I don't have a social security number. That was the end of the argument. It was the end of the case. She patted me on my little pointed head and she said, okay, little Georgie, you can go home now. Now, boys and girls, government took our gold away from us because gold is property. And when you work for gold, you're trading your labor, which is property, for gold, which is property. And by the way, we have our gold coin back. I just got a pleasant piece of information. We just looked this up. In 2006, see, I'm over 65. My wife is over 65. We can earn $18,000 a year now. God bless government. I love them. 18,000. So I plugged in 18,000 into my famous Sharp EL1197G2 calculator. And then I divided that by 50. Because the new gold coins, the new Eagles, are called $50 gold pieces. I can earn 360 of those gold coins before I have to report that to the government as income. But when I trade those gold coins in, I get the purchasing power of $587 an ounce. So I'm going to take that times 587. That's $211,320 a year in equivalent purchasing power. Now here's where the taxable event comes in. If I take those gold coins into the coin store and I trade them in and get paper dollars, I've got a taxable transaction. Now I got to pay tax on $211,000 worth of income. Oh, that's not very smart. Oh, I don't want to trade my gold coins in. I want to go out and buy things with gold coins. You know, one day I bought a piece of ground and I paid a guy $6,400 in gold. He traded it in and got $50,000 in paper, and then he had to pay a $6,800 capital gain tax on that paper. You know, some people love paper and they love paying tax, and some people love property. And then they pay tithe. Now I have to pay tithe, but you can't serve two masters, boys and girls, and God told you that in Matthew 6:24. He said, don't waste my time trying to serve two masters. You can serve the United States of America and Florida, Mississippi, and Michigan if you want to. Or you can serve me. Do one or the other, but not both. So tuck that one away in your heart. That might make you some extra pocket change. One of these days. A little extra pocket change. So I keep telling you, it's more advantageous to obey God and keep His commandments and practice thou shalt not steal and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag than it is to practice the income tax and social security, which takes a third of everything you create and produce. And that's only two of the 14 taxes. Yeah, I got to leave it right there. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.